Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Achtung, achtung. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk USA, the Second World War podcast of choice, with me, Al Murray, James Holland, and John McManus. Hello, gents. How are we? Have we all recovered from the last episode of Masters of the Air?
Oh, God. Yeah, it was emotional, wasn't it?
Sad it's over.
I'm feeling more emotional that it's over than I am about the emotion on the screen, I've got to say, although that was quite emotional. I mean, imagine my joy when I discovered it was an hour and 20 minutes or whatever.
Yeah. And I was worried it was going to be a 45 or something. And like, that's just not long enough.
No, I was a complete sucker for the ending when it's the guys making it in spite of everything. And then seeing who they were in the, you know, hearing their life story. And I was also sat there brimful of spoilers with Mrs. Murray going, well, I don't want to, I know what happens to Rosie Rosenthal. I know what he ends up doing, you know, and having to keep shtum on that. But that's what's really brilliant about it is seeing someone who doesn't know deal with it and react with it. It's great, wasn't it?
Was a great character in it. I thought the actor was brilliant and brilliantly portrayed. And that episode, that fifth episode, the Munster raid in October 43, that was just top telly.
Yeah, tremendous stuff.
So well done. And it just closed the loop so well on it all. And Alexander Jefferson, who's really a legend on so many levels, and to get a sense, too, of his educational career, and that he lived until 2022.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. Our business for this episode, and thanks for joining us, everybody, is to, every now and again, James and I, we get out this extraordinary almanac of the Second World War day by day. It's the sort of thing we kind of had in our school library. We look at the date 80 years ago, the week 80 years ago, and have a look at what's going on. The headline for March 1944, for this third week, or third month, it was Monday the 13th of March. The week begins on the 13th of March. Burmese battlefield springs to life as Allies attack. Because this is the thing, is actually there are several moving parts in Burma at this juncture, aren't there? There's
the big Imphal battle, which is kicking off, you know, 80 years ago this week, a week earlier than Slim has anticipated. But there's also Merrill's Marauders, which I think is
Operation Thursday with the Chindits on the 9th
and,
of March.
And the Chindits, yeah. And I think the interesting thing is with Merrill's Marauders is it's a name that runs off the tongue very easily. It's got, I would say, a pretty high recognition factor, but I would also argue that most people haven't got the faintest idea who Merrill's Marauders were, what they were doing, where they were, why they were there, or anything. Do you think that's fair enough? I mean, I think there's one exception here, and that is that John McManus knows everything there is to know about Miles Morales.
I wish everything was a no, but I know too much, I think. It's such a weird deal, and thank God they are called Merrill's Marauders, because their actual real administrative name is just so ridiculous. The 5307th Composite Unit. Which somebody said, one of the guys in the outfit said, it sounds like an address in Los Angeles or something. And he's right. I mean, there was this whole complex administrator reason, but the bottom line is that they're not able to give it a regimental combat team name just yet. The media dubbed it just Merrill's Marauders after Frank Merrill, who ends up as the ranking officer. Now, he was a major protege of Joseph Stilwell, who of course is the American theater commander in CBI. And Merrill
being China, Burma, India. We should just say that.
Yeah, China, Burma, India. Out. Sorry. Yeah. So, but the interesting thing is, there's a full colonel named Hunter, who really is a kind of a key player too. And it's a bit of a power play between Merrill and him, because Merrill isn't quite physically up to this really strenuous campaign we're going to have.
So, who is Merrill?
Frank Merrill is a fascinating dude. So he's a prior enlisted guy who was a cavalryman who ends up going to West Point, getting a commission through West Point, and is having a pretty successful career. And he's on Stilwell's staff when Stilwell comes to Burma in 1942. He's one of the people who makes it out of Burma with him, during the famous trek to India at that point in time. So he's really kind of Stilwell's right-hand man, and it's almost kind of freaky. If you look at photos of them, they look alike. I mean, he looks like he'd be Stilwell's son or something, and so he's sort of a mini-me, and yet he's not just some sort of robotic yes man or something. Frank Merrill is a really quite extraordinary officer on some levels in terms of his leadership ethos. It's his physical body that can't quite stand up to what this really means of operating in some of the worst terrain in the world in a light infantry capacity. So he had already struggled during the trek out in 42. In 44, he famously, during this campaign in North Burma, suffers, I think, 3 heart attacks, something like that.
Oh my God.
And wants to stay, desperately wants to stay, but they just simply have to evacuate him out eventually. So Colonel Hunter becomes sort of the key guy at the tactical level, controlling things. And he's another West Pointer, and he is an infantryman's infantryman. I mean, absolutely a terrific leader on many levels.
I'm looking at Merrill now, and you're right. He's got a pipe kind of clenched between his teeth. He's got the round specs. He's kind of, he just looks just like Stilwell.
Interesting about Stilwell is he, well before it became fashionable, he wore his hair in a high and tight hairstyle, which becomes very fashionable for later generations of U.S. Army soldiers. But in World War II, you don't really see that a lot, but Stilwell had that. And so Merrill kind of imitates that at times. He was certainly heavily influenced by Stilwell, as you can imagine. But I think he was influenced by the best aspects of Stilwell, the honesty, the kind of commitment to your soldiers kind of thing. But he's not really involved that much with the whole diplomacy side of the operation of dealing with Chiang Kai-shek, at least in the spring of 44. He's on the ground with this regimental size unit of light infantry that in tandem with special operations forces that are part of the OSS and Kachin tribesmen in northern Burma are going to have this kind of deep penetration campaign more or less behind Japanese lines, is I guess the way we'll call it. But it's really kind of just in flux
This is northeast Burma on the China border.
Yeah, and the purpose of the whole thing is to extend the road from India all the way through North Burma to China to have a supply route into China. The combined chiefs.
This is the Lado Road.
What becomes known as the Lado Road, the Stilwell Road, the Burma Road. I mean, it's very confusing, but it's all mainly the same thing. And the combined chiefs have said to Stilwell, this is your main initiative, so that we can get, road-bound supplies to China. So the whole campaign is designed to kind of buttress that. And it's supposed to be supported by a Chinese movement of Force Y coming out of coming from like southwest China into northern Burma to protect the flank. But also, we tend to forget, Merrill's Marauders is not just operating out there alone. There's 2 nationalist Chinese divisions working with them, the 22nd and the 38th divisions, I think. And so it's a, like we said, there's a lot of moving parts of this operation. But I think the bottom line for it is that the Chinese are fighting well, and Merrill's Marauders becomes this really kind of striking light infantry force that constantly catches the Japanese off guard here, mainly working in columns because it's such jungle-heavy terrain that you've got to, whatever trails you've got, you're working in sort of battalion-sized columns that have a recon element in front. And so that, but the other force multiplier tends to get overlooked too, is Merrill's Marauders has some Japanese American soldiers who are every bit members of the unit who are going to operate as basically intel specialists. One of them, Roy Matsumoto, eventually taps into Japanese communications and is listening to what they're saying. And that's incredibly good intel to know exactly what the Japanese are intending to do. This makes a tactical difference on the ground. He's just one example of who are with the unit.
John, I mean, how many U.S. ground troops are sent to China then? So they're coming into Burma from...
They come into India. No, they come into India first. So they have that trek up from whichever port it is they land in India. And they go north via train. And eventually they're going to, so there were training camps in India.
They're probably going to somewhere like, presumably they're going to somewhere like Dimapur, aren't they?
They come into Bombay actually, initially.
Bombay, okay.
To train. And then they're sent east.
So they don't go to China. They're never in China.
No, they're never in China. They go to India, to Burma, and there's training camps for those aforementioned Chinese divisions in northeast India. So they're going to go there first and get finisher training. So in Ord Wingate, you know, Chindit guy. Yeah, well, and
I was going to ask. I mean, that with long range penetration being that supposedly having its proof of concept. What cross fertilization is there with Wingate and his experience?
This is so funny. I mean, so
because I'm such a Wingate fan.
Great infusion of combat manpower here. And I've been doing this for a year now. I'm going to show these guys. So Wingate really helps train these guys more than anybody. If we can say, well, they're really superb light infantry operators, who's responsible for that? Wingate deserves a credit as much as anybody. So he figures he's going to add them to his whole Chindit operation. Instead, Stillwell's like, dude, no way is there going to be an American combat unit that I've been lobbying for 2 years come to this theater and me not control it. And so there's this showdown moment when Wingate realizes this, and he tells the commanders of Merrill's Marauders, he says, you can tell General Stillwell to go take his Americans and stick them up his arse, you know. So I don't blame him for being angry, but I also don't blame Stillwell for feeling the way he did.
No.
That's really funny.
Yeah, so Stillwell, you have these sort of parallel campaigns going on. Wingate doing his Chindit thing, and then obviously Imphal and Kohima and all that. But Stillwell is doing his thing on his own. But to his credit, he and Slim are eventually going to coordinate because Slim's dealing with that crisis farther west. So it's very, very messy. Plus, the other moving part is Stillwell trying to get Chiang Kai-shek to authorize Force Y to cross a major river to enter the campaign in North Burma. And Chiang Kai-shek is holding off on that because he feels that... he's been hung out to dry in terms of lend lease and what he wants for, you know, the strategic priority in 1944.
Yeah.
Really messy.
Yeah. How big is the 5307 composite unit provisional?
Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it, Al? Yes. it's about 3,000. I'm going
to
stick with guys. That.
You're not going to get me to call them by their media friendly name.
It's impressive.
I'm going to stick with it.
But how are they? Okay, so there's 3,000 of these guys. I mean, you know, where they're being recruited from, and how do they get recruited and flying into Bombay?
Okay, this is what's so fascinating. Some of these guys have come actually from Panama, from the 33rd Infantry in Panama, and they're just done with that whole garrison duty. The venereal disease rates are through the roof. It's just a bad situation. And they're given the opportunity, hey, you know, you can go to a better command. It's very dysfunctional there. And so some of them volunteer from there. Some of them are coming from stateside training camps, but a lot of them are coming from the South Pacific, from guys who were in the 37th Infantry Division who fought in the Battle of New Georgia and are figuring, hey, you know, this is going to be a better go than rotting here in the Solomons or in New Guinea or whatever. And as things turn out, of course, it's going to be much worse than whatever they were coming from. So Merrill's Marauders are a really interesting mix of some pretty hard characters, some troublemakers in the army, with some really idealistic guys, with some people who don't know what they're getting into. It's a fascinating mix of people. They're all white, as were, you know, most infantry combat units. But interestingly, you know, they're going to have a lot of discourse with the African-American engineers who are building the road, and they get along famously. I mean, Merrill's Marauders develops a very good ethos of racial inclusion and cooperation. And I think really Frank Merrill is partially responsible for that, too, as is Hunter, who's very fair minded. So it's just a fascinating kind of sociological context here, I think.
And what they do, is it perceived to be a success?
I mean, yeah, I think long term it is. It becomes kind of legendary because ultimately they do succeed in getting to their main objective, which is a town called Myitkyina, or the Americans call it Michinar. And the significance of this place, confluence town right along what would be the road, and there's an airfield there. There's always an airfield, right? So this is a enormous odyssey from February 44 all the way to basically May and June, with a siege, you know, in the latter part and all that. So it is successful in getting that, but at the price of basically destroying this fine unit. They are wrecked. They're done. I mean, so strategically, it's a success because Slim does his thing so well to the west at Imphal and Kohima, and because the Japanese are foolish enough not to coordinate everything they're doing in Burma with Ichigo in China, which is happening kind of concurrently too, and is a real serious threat to Chiang Kai-shek. So ultimately, yes, it is a success, but at an enormous price. But, you know, this, if we're saying, we talk about this all the time, don't we? Especially when we've been talking about Italy, how combat units go in and they just get wasted, and you run through all the manpower and you replace it. And that's what's happening in Burma. It's just that you don't have access to any replacements. You're last in line, literally last in line strategically, you know, for global priority among the Allied commanders.
Yeah, you're right at the back of the queue, aren't you? How do they cope with the privations of the terrain? Because, you know, famously, the first Chinned expedition, most of the men who go are so sick on the return that they can't ever go into combat again. Chinnits leave their wounded behind and all this just horrendous, horrendous things that the circumstances dictate of those operating like that operationally. What happens to, you know, I'm not going to call them that. How do the
good luck, here we go, let's try it, the
5307th composite unit, provisional, how do they cope with the environment? Because it's just impossibly hard.
Within a month to 2 months, everybody has malaria or yellow fever, dysentery, some sort of skin problem. They're in rotten shape. The thing they do have that maybe the Chindits wouldn't have quite as much earlier in the war is more air power right at their disposal. They're generally being resupplied by air, and they're being evacuated, the wounded are, by air. They're really quite ingenious with how they're going to land some of these small aircraft in clearings and then get some of the worst wounded or sick out of there as things go on. But there's, of course, an expectation that you are going to go to the absolute limit. And so most of these guys are going to lose anywhere from 20 to almost 40 pounds and deal with all those diseases in spite of precautions. It's not like they go in blind. I mean, they're trying their best to avoid disease, but it's just the environment. I mean, so it is a level of privation that I don't know, certainly first among equals, among any other American combat soldiers in the war. And the other thing, too, as I mentioned, is, you know, there's no replacements as this thing goes on, which creates a pressure, a command pressure, to keep sending people back. So there's all these, there's instances that are probably true, although, I mean, I really looked into this and wasn't able to 100% document it, but instances in which there was pressure on the medical folks to basically remove wound tags from those who could still walk and manipulate a weapon or whatever and send them back, even though they're about to be evacuated. And you can imagine once that rumor gets hold of soldiers, that's rough.
Yeah. We're trying to look at this week in 1944, and we've spent half already of the episode talking about 5307th composite unit provisional. Unit Galahad. The other name's all right, isn't it? Galahad's good. Why not Galahad?
Mm-hmm. That is a better name. It really is.
It's a better name, but alliteration wins the day. Anyway, we will take a short break and we'll be back with more of what's going on around the world in the Second World War 80 years ago.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk USA with me, Al Murray, John McManus, and James Holland. So that's one side of the world, but of course, it's a global phenomenon, the Second World War, clues in the name. And what we have here is what's going on in Hungary on the 19th of March, 1944. So, I mean, in brief, it's the Germans make their move, isn't it, on the Hungarians?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one of the parts of the war that most people know very little about is what's going on in kind of Eastern Europe, you know, Romania, Bulgaria, Albania, Hungary. But the events of March 1944 have unspeakably sinister consequences. You know, it's just horrific what happens as a result of this. Basically, they seize Hungary, don't they? And Admiral Horvey, it's you know, he's kaput. Then it's rounding up the Jews time.
That's the major consequence of it all, is that to me is one of the war's ultimate greatest tragedies. Here is a community, a Jewish community, that had largely been beyond the reach of the Germans for much of the war, even though there's a fascist regime. And now, under the pressure of operations and events in 1944, the Germans are able to kind of bully that regime into turning over the Hungarian Jews, most of whom end up in death camps in Poland throughout 1944, just as the death camps are about to end. It's so tragic and so horrible that it's almost hard to even study it, you know, because it's just so late in the game. There were so many ways to avoid this. And so we're talking, I mean, I don't know, what is it? It's well into six figures. What, 400,000 people, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. And, you know, they extend that, you know, the infamous railway line that goes under the arches at Birkenau. Auschwitz-Birkenau, when you see those sort of that famous picture of the kind of the tower in the middle of the arch and the railway going underneath the middle of it and the kind of barracks either side of it. The railway line used to be kind of, you know, a mile and a half away, the railway halt, and they'd have to come off the wagons and then walk across this sort of flat, open land until you got to the kind of main entrance at Birkenau. And Birkenau is the camp that's built subsequent to Auschwitz I, which is the original Polish army barracks, which then get taken over. That railway line gets built in the spring of 1944, specifically to fast speed up the processing of Hungary's Jews, and it's just it's horrible. And that you still got the kind of little platforms there now, and they get out, and you know that's where you're divided up, and those who are kind of sort of 18 to 25 get kind of sidelined on as workers, and everyone else gets, you know, it's literally straight into the gas chambers. I mean, it's absolutely horrendous. But I think it's worth, isn't it, just mentioning, you know, Hungary's story in the Second World War, because again, I think it's sort of, most people don't realize that. I mean, there is a kingdom of Hungary, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's come out of the Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah, but they've been sort of semi-detached, haven't they? Or tried to maintain a degree of autonomy within an alliance with the Germans, haven't they? So they're very keen on fighting the Soviet Union until it starts going wrong. And the levels of, within Hungary, the levels of sort of anti-Semitism can go up as well as down, can't they? It's the thing. So they're in this very odd, I mean, it's not a symbiotic relationship with the Germans as such, but they're certainly firmly in their orbit. Like you say, they managed to maintain a sense of autonomy in that their Jews aren't, the Hungarian Jews are not being given up quite prepared to, are they? There are anti-Jewish measures and there are pogroms and stuff, but it hasn't tipped over into the full scale way that the Germans are doing things. One of the ways they're maintaining their independence, isn't it? It's their autonomy.
Yeah, and they had sent troops to fight on the Eastern Front too.
Yeah.
And so they've had that experience by now, which has not worked out well. And of course, the Soviets are at their door and they're worried about it.
They're one of a bevy of states, aren't they, that joined the Axis in the autumn of 1940. You know, France is out. Kind of the impression is that Britain is beaten too. And yet in the 1930s, you know, Hungary has created ties with Nazi Germany and fascist Italy and sort of, you know, they've been trading partners. So although it looks like a sort of cynical, I want to get a kind of, you know, let's get in with the guys that look like they're winning. Actually, politically, Hungary is closer aligned to fascist Italy and Nazi Germany anyway, by the time it joins the Axis.
And benefits from the Munich Pact in getting land at the expense of Czechoslovakia. Right. And ironically, Poland did too. And Poland was about to be on the receiving end after that. And it's really good. When you look at it from the diplomatic point of view, you do have this kind of chain reaction in 1939-40 of the expedience of a lot of European states saying, well, we're going to have to align with Germany now. And then that empowers their own intrinsic fascists, like in Romania, like in Hungary, you know, wherever. But 1943 and 44, they're starting to kind of backpedal and looking for a kind of an escape hatch. The Hungarians don't really have that luxury in the sense because the Soviets are right at their door and they desperately need help from Germany to defend against Soviet invaders, which is, of course, the ultimate Hungarian nightmare, which they've brought on themselves in a way. Right. So that's partly what strikes me about this thing with the Hungarian Jewish population is there's a lot of different ways this could have turned out in which you don't have this monumental tragedy of basically a genocide against Hungarian Jews. It's under the pressure of these sort of domino tragedies that then unfold in 1944. With Hungary itself being a battleground, Budapest famously, obviously the Holocaust coming to full bore, to where I could be wrong, but I don't know that there's any other country that loses a higher percentage of its Jews except maybe Poland. Certainly Hungary is right up there.
It's a hideous business. And it also, I mean, I always think if what you need is a clarification of what Germany's war aims are, this is... Here it is. You know, they're one of the things they're desperate to do is get their hands on the Jewish population so they could subject it to the final solution, isn't it? If there's ever any doubt about what the Second World War's for, or one of the major central war aims of the Nazi government, then look at this and you'll see right there, because after all there is anti-Semitic law in Hungary. They you aren't allowed to do certain jobs, people are being killed and so on, but it ain't enough if you're the Hitler government. They aren't doing anything like enough, and the minute Hungary's in a vulnerable position, this is what the Germans elect to do. Whenever anyone gets into the idea of, well, where does the genocide of the European Jews fit into the German picture of the Second World War? The idea that it's kind of a byproduct or it's happened by accident or it's like a product of acceleration or anything. Well, what's going on here?
This is Lucy Davidovich's thesis right here, laid out in front of us.
Right.
Yeah.
War against the Jews. Yeah. And it's precisely that. And because if you think about it, especially by 1944, the Germans have a lot more important things to be dealing with.
Exactly.
Than this.
And of course, the guy who's processing all this, of course, is Eichmann.
This is his moment when
this is his the main sort of case for the prosecution is what he does in with the Hungary's Jews. Yeah, so it's 437,402, of which only 15,000 avoid deportation. And of those nearly 440,000, 90% are executed immediately. And when you go, I mean, I'm sure lots of listeners will have been to Birkenau and been to Auschwitz there. And nearly all the photographs they have around the place are of Hungarian Jews arriving straight in, because the railway line is still there. You know, it's the gas chambers are still there.
And it's so genocidal by this point. They almost don't need them to work anymore. They just want to kill them. And this is the place to do it. You know, it's
there's desperation because they're losing and they've got to, you know, fulfill their dastardly plan as quickly as possible, and the building of the railway line under the arch is and right up to the gas chambers is all about speeding up the process. I mean, it's industrial killing at its absolute zenith, and it's the terrible tragedy and misfortune of Hungary's Jews, that the people that are a focus of this. I mean, it's absolutely hideous.
It's grim.
And just to go back to Masters of the Air, I thought they handled that side of things in the last episode very well.
Yeah,
it was handled very, very well, with Rosie taking a look, because it really happened. I mean, Rosie did see this, and I thought that was extremely well done.
Yeah.
What
did the Hungarian government do when suddenly they have their collar felt by the Germans? You know, when the moment comes when they're sort of shut down, do they resist?
Well, Horvy tries to stop it. Admiral Horvy is the regent of Hungary, yeah. and he's the guy who's sort of been in bed with Hitler and then suddenly changes his mind. And he stays in power, but he's obviously a sort of puppet regent by that point. And he tries to stop it, but he doesn't stop it until July, by which time all but 15,000 have been sort of packed off to Auschwitz. So it's kind of too little too late.
And by then, of course, the Soviets are chewing up his country.
Yeah, so what's he going to do anyway? I mean, I suppose at that point you start thinking, how do we pivot to being nice to the Soviets if you're him?
Yeah, how do we exactly?
That's pretty difficult.
Yeah. And that's the other dynamic in play, because I think, a lot of Hungarians are like pragmatic, saying, okay, well, let's make nice with the Soviets now and somehow get out of this. But of course, now Hungary has just become another barrier place that the Germans are trying to stop the encroachment of the Soviets into Germany itself, too. So it might as well be any other country at that point, too. And yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating, though, isn't it? Because the Jews in Poland, if you buy the German argument that they're then part of the Reich, and your problem is Jews in Germany, then that's why they're marked for extirpation. But these are Jews in a country that isn't part of the Reich. It makes it completely clear what's at the core here, doesn't it? That it doesn't even have that fig leaf, as it were, that they have in Poland, where they say, well, this is Germany now, so and we don't want Jews in Germany. This is like, we don't want them anywhere, because it's not as though the idea is that Hungary is being properly incorporated into the Reich, is it?
No, this is Vansi
not at all
put into practice, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
nakedly, yeah.
But you know, you have also got the Red Army at this time within spitting distance of Romania, which is a neighbor, of course, of Hungary's. You know, it's what makes it even more grotesque, because clearly the Germans are losing by this point. Clearly it's all going to be over. Clearly it's going to be overrun by communists. So who cares? You know, if it's overrun by communists, why as a national socialist would you care whether there's Jews there or not? I mean, that might be your ideology. You might be deeply anti-Semitic. It's not going to be your concern in pretty quick order, because Soviet Union is about to invade.
Well, unless it's that your ideology is, you know, it's Ragnarok, isn't it? You're trying to bring about the end of the world now, rather than the German Empire, aren't you?
But it makes it even more despicable. That's the point.
It's just hideous.
It's strikingly similar to what the Japanese do in Manila, because obviously they're going to lose. It's about over. You know, you're done.
Yeah,
and yet
indeed.
You decide to have these horrible atrocities against the residents of Manila, against Filipinos, in the tens of thousands. It's very similar to that, I think, in that sense that you're about to go down and then you become more criminal, more bloodthirsty. Part of what makes it horrifying, I think.
Yeah.
So on that cheery note, what else have we got?
Well, the Finns reject Soviet peace overtures on the 17th of March, which is interesting because again, you know, we are at the stage of the war where maybe it's time to accept Soviet peace overtures because because the other thing that's changed for the Finns is that not only are the Germans losing, but the Soviets have got their act together in a way that they didn't have in 1939, 5 years previously, and it might be worth having a rethink, right? An interesting moment. This is sort of running parallel, really, isn't it? All these countries east of Poland, middle and eastern Europe, have got to now pick a side, haven't they? They've got to figure out which way things are going. Whereas 3 years before, they're all happily, you know, they called it a crusade against the Soviet Union, didn't they? It was a crusade against Bolshevism, and it was couched as such and marketed as such and presented as such to the public. And here they are having to go, about that.
Not so much.
Yeah, maybe we don't, you know, maybe, but the Finns are hanging on here. And you have the Soviet army is near the Romanian border as well. And is in Ukraine as well, breaks through in Ukraine as well. I mean, this is a time of the dominoes tumbling in the other direction, isn't it, really, for the Germans? I mean, again, I've often said that by mid-1943, if the rational German government, that's where you go, you know what, maybe we don't really need, maybe we don't need all of Ukraine. And you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But by this stage, a rational German government is surely going to be thinking, you know what? There's got to be. We could talk our way out of this now. Surely,
those are the pragmatic entities who ultimately decide to make the attempt on Hitler's life. I mean, it's that. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. They're trapped too by this point too. I mean, I just think it's amazing how gutsy the Finns are. Not only do they not knuckle under these guys in 1939 and fight like hell, now in 1944, when things really are getting serious, they're going to say, no, we're not going to take the Soviet deal. We're going to keep on keeping on.
And now in 2024, they're also getting serious because they've got more artillery pieces than any other country in Europe.
And part of NATO now. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So all power to the Finns. I also quite like this. I'm interested by the Irish travel ban. Irish travel banned as a security risk. So this is really interesting. So De Valera gets sort of very uncooperative with the British. And so the British go, right, okay, do you want to play hardball? We'll play hardball. And that's basically what happens. So basically they just, but you know, with the invasion coming, because they won't release Axis diplomats and any Axis staff, and because of the risk of spying, basically Britain and the Allies go, right, well, you're sealed. So not a single one of the 164,000 Irish people serving in the British Armed Forces, they're not allowed to return home. 250,000 Irish citizens working in the UK, they're not allowed to return home either.
It's a sovereignty move by De Valera, as was remaining neutral in the first place, of course. But it also points to Ireland's vulnerability by its very location next door to Britain. And ultimately, obviously, looking to the United States to be a point of deliverance for that. But the United States also, we're not going to be able to help you at this point. You know what I mean? It's we're on board with this whole seal off. Now, in the future, we'll talk. But it also shows how serious things are.
But there's nothing stopping Ireland being neutral, but in a pro-West, pro-democracy kind of way.
It kind of is, you know, I mean, especially for Americans.
Why would you allow Axis and German diplomats to be in Ireland? I mean,
again, that's a sovereignty move because it's, well, from an Irish point of view, and I'm speaking now as an Irish American, so just full disclosure.
Okay.
The point of view is that for generations, of course, Britain is the main enemy. That's who you're trying to get your independence from. And of course, you want the recovery of Ulster at this point, too. You know, so from that point, Britain has always been the traditional enemy. And so it's very hard to take seriously the fact that all of a sudden you have Nazi Germany, which is a completely different animal in a way. If you're looking at it as a sort of committed IRA person, you would say, well, regardless of who Hitler is or whatever, he could help us against our main enemy, Britain. And the realization of that, who you're really talking about here in relation to the Nazis and all that, I think comes slowly for some, including De Valera. Who is a bit more on the radical side, though he is a pragmatist, ultimately. What he really wants is a bona fide, independent, sovereign Irish Republic, which obviously we'll have in 1949. You know, he wants away from this free state business and all that. And he wants, obviously, to pivot to the United States. But I think it's the workout of that. And the ultimate manifestation of that, of course, is when Hitler commits suicide. you know, the De Valera's government conveys apologies, condolences to the German government, which is sort of infamous to this day, I think, among some people, understandably.
Yeah,
so.
Quite rightly so. What a thing to do.
I mean, they are pretty much, they are west facing though, the Irish, really, at this stage of the war, aren't they? Because they know in the end they have to be. Who are they going to pick between? You know,
obvious, and it's already happened. Yeah. And the ties with the United States are so strong. Yeah. Irish Americans have such influence in the U.S. Yeah. by now, especially in Democratic Party circles. It's still complex even to this day because of the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain, of which then Ireland becomes a complicating factor in that too, because obviously Irish and British interests will diverge, you know. So I just think you see this play in World War II. But if I'm speaking from an American point of view, and I'm an American aviator who goes down in air, I mean, I'm going to be treated pretty darn well for the most part. So I think the Irish government really does come down on the Allied side, not really out of coziness with Britain, but out of sympathy with the United States, ultimately, and maybe pragmatically too. Plus, obviously, we've got so many people training in Ulster, ultimately too, and whatever.
Yeah.
But a fascinating dynamic, though, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also March the 15th, the US steps up attacks on Admiralty Islands. So March 15th, US troops of 8th Cavalry, 2nd Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division have attacked Manus Island in the Admiralty Islands off the north coast of New Guinea. And this is MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Area Command. What's going on there, John?
This seems so innocuous, but actually it is one of the major events of the Pacific War. It is a major game changer for MacArthur because, I mean, he's basically, by early 44, captured about 250 miles of New Guinea wilderness. And obviously he wants to get back to the Philippines and all that. In the meantime, of course, you know, Nimitz has advanced to the Gilberts and now the Marshalls and, you know, pretty promising kind of advance. So Los Negros is the first place that MacArthur is going to invade. And the significance is there's a key airfield there, the Momote airfield, that will allow him to step up the pace of operations on the New York, New Guinea coast really quite dramatically. And this is really one of the finer moments for MacArthur's leadership in World War II. He has to make a very tough call about sending a battalion-sized unit in to grab this airfield and then try and build from there based on very limited intelligence. And he will do so, of course, and it's going to lead to a pretty tough battle that goes on at Los Negros and eventually Manus, which is like right next door, that plays out over the course of about 4 to 6 weeks. And some of the most ferocious fighting. So the 1st Cavalry Division, I would argue, is going to be one of the finer units in the entire U.S. Army that begins its first combat there and ultimately culminates in the Battle of Manila in 1945. And obviously the unit is famous now, you know, for Vietnam and afterwards. But it's largely forgotten, you know, what happened at Los Negros and Manus 80 years ago today. But it is a major reason why the Americans are going to come back to the Philippines. And I think that is, you know, such a point of significance. The 1st Cavalry Division loses 326 killed in action in that fighting. The Japanese lose 10 times that easily, if not more.
And that, for those who don't know, that's it's in the Bismarck Sea. It's around the corner from New Britain. It's sort of off the north-northwest coast north by northwest coast of Papua New Guinea, essentially. So it's over the other side of the Australian side of Papua New Guinea, isn't it? Sits up
north, so that those airfields allow you to really project air power and protect your ships, you know, as you're sailing west. So it allows the invasion of Hollandia, which happens in April of 44. And I think we should have an episode on that because it's just so fascinating. Hollandia is just massive in terms of the war in the South Pacific and in terms of how well it's executed and all that. So Los Negros and Manus beget that in the same way that the Marshalls, the success there is going to beget Nimitz being able to get to the Marianas in the summer of 44, which obviously is of massive importance so that we have airfields from which to bomb Japan itself.
Yeah. To take the offensive that much further. Jim, what have you got?
It's just a very quick one. British miners sign a 4-year pay deal because, of course, there were miner strikes going on in the first part of 1944, notoriously, right. And everyone getting very kind of sort of hot under the collar about it if you're fighting at the front. They become graded as 1 in 20 become graded as skilled craftsmen, able to earn over £5 a week, which is $20 in 1944 money. And union leaders on the back of this pay offer appeal tonight for return to work by 60,000 South Yorkshire miners. Wow. I mean, can you believe it? I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, we've touched on it very briefly, haven't we, in the past about the huge number of strikes in the US in 1943. I think it's the single year of more strikes in the United States than any other year in its history, I believe. And of course, you know, this was the last great strike before 1980.
And in other tunnelling news, the Great Escape happens this week, 25th of March. But we haven't got time for that. although, of course, that did pop up in Masters of the Air, of course, which I think was very interesting to see it from a different perspective for once, rather than a British perspective. Anyway, thanks everyone for listening. We hope that. To be honest, what we've done, as usual, there's three or four pages that cover this period, and we've done four of them out of the 16.
Yeah, there's much more, as always.
Much more, 20 items. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. We will see you all again very, very soon. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
See ya.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.